Well, good morning, my dear brethren and sisters. We'll start our meeting this morning by singing hymn number 268, hymn 268. If thou but suffer God to guide thee, and hope in him through all thy ways, he'll give thee strength, whate'er betide thee, and bear thee through the evil days. Who trust in God's unchanging love, build on the rock that naught can move. Hymn 268.
Thank you.
Before we invite Brother James to give us the words of exhortation, we'll sing together hymn 269. Oft in danger, oft in woe, onward, brethren, onward go. Fight the fight, maintain the strife, strengthened with the bread of life. Hymn 269. Now it's my pleasure to invite Brother James to give us the words of exhortation. James.
Good morning, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends. With every fresh affront on people's ways of life which hits the headlines, it can feel that we're finally very close to the collapse of man's current fragile state of affairs. Yet from a physical point of view, most of us are not actually barricaded against something as a last line of defence. What is it like to be under siege? To be terrified for your life, trying to push away an enemy at the gates? Today's reading, with its comment on the end of Zedekiah's reign, is quiet on the details. But by the end of 18 months, we read that the common people were effectively starved. This would have been truly abominable, absolutely horrible. As we know from other accounts in the scripture, even the dead would have been recycled for food. Unfortunately, I doubt that any of us here have any idea just exactly how horrific that was. The warriors too had no more left to give. They would have been on their last reserves, fighting to the death. It was a case, eventually, of each man only looking after himself. Any hope that Zedekiah had of a false monarchy with false systems of worship, not only rebelling against a foreign power, but also containing a mutiny, was dashed. A starving, malnourished, depressed people with a powerful army outside the gates is bound to rebel against a powerless, incapable puppet. Even the best warriors, who might have retained some sort of allowance, would have known and cared for someone who was deemed less valuable to the puppet king. This puppet king had now rebelled against the power by which he'd been put in place, but he had no hope of success in doing so. He was foolish enough to fail to see that black cloud which would rise on the horizon very quickly. And his city had bronze and precious goods, but it hadn't got the basics of things like a food supply. And in 2 Kings 24, verse 16, we even read that Nebuchadnezzar had taken the best of the country's warfaring talent captive. He was probably using the elite ones of the talent pool against the rebellion in Jerusalem. After the city was taken and most of its people deported or killed, we read that the very poorest people were given the opportunity to take care of the land. And the more I think about it, the more I realise how clever this tactic should have been, at least in human eyes. Because here were people who would have, by this point, have been living on virtually nil rations for about a month, with turmoil, utter chaos around them. Jeremiah records that they owned nothing, not a jot, and they were then able to grasp, effectively, any bit of land that they wanted. A prosperous land, a land which could have worked very hard for them. And I'm sure they would have known and been quite envious of any bit which could have grown the best food. Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, swore an oath to them and their men, assuring them, "Don't be afraid to serve the Chaldeans. Live in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will go well for you. As for me, I am going to live in Mizpah to represent you before the Chaldeans who come to us. As for you, gather wine, summer fruit, and oil. Place them in your storage jars, and live in the cities you've captured." And then, following on from those verses, which is Jeremiah 40, verses 9 and 10, the next couple of verses reveal how the scattered people came together and did do broadly the same thing. They all ate and drank and gathered things together, and they were reasonably loyal to the ruler who'd been there, put there for them. And they accepted that although they were nothing, they had at least been given everything. Now, sometimes, as an illustration, these sorts of human tactics are used by God, and we can clearly see here that he knows how human minds work and who they'll trust. And this story so clearly illustrates that although the people of Judah were happy to trust the ruler, it seems that they still did not have the underlying foundation of trust in God. Gedaliah didn't quite believe that this way of life could be under threat, or that he should do anything. But it was under threat. 2 Kings goes quite quiet here on the full sequence of events, but Jeremiah records in great detail how Gedaliah's rule was overturned, Ishmael was dealt with, but then the people fled to Egypt against God's wishes. The trust in people had failed, and there was little in the way of hope in God to fall back on. What follows this is a remarkable prophecy about the life of Egypt itself, the very place from which God had withdrawn his people. And this is not to mention what had already happened to Egypt, as we have seen in 2 Kings chapter 24, Babylon had decimated their outer territories. And Jeremiah says that daughter Egypt will be put to shame, given into the hands of the people of the north. The Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says, "I am about to bring punishment on Ammon, god of Thebes, on Pharaoh, on Egypt and her gods and her kings, and on those who rely on Pharaoh. I will give them into the hands of those who want to kill them, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and his officers. Later, however, Egypt will be inhabited, as in times past, declares the Lord." So all of these things happened at once. All of these things were being spoken, and Egypt wasn't perhaps a safe haven in reality. And almost directly after the words about daughter Egypt being put to shame, in Jeremiah chapter 46, there come prophecies about other nations. But between these two are the following verses. "But you, my servant Jacob, do not be afraid, and do not be discouraged, Israel. For without fail I will save you from far away, and your descendants from the land of their captivity. Jacob will return and have calm and quiet, with no one to frighten them. And you, my servant Jacob, do not be afraid. This is the Lord's declaration, for I will be with you. I will bring destruction on all the nations where I have banished you, but I will not bring destruction on you. I will discipline you with justice, and I will by no means leave you unpunished. Even when the poorest people of the land had been given it all, had their leader torn away, been rescued, and told to stay where they were, they would not stay. God was calling them constantly by delivering them time and time again. But just because they had little did not mean that they had great trust instead. One day they would have nothing to frighten them, but the true fulfillment of that era wasn't quite yet. The allure of Egypt was often great for God's people. It was sometimes a thing that they should have resisted. But don't we read that God called his son from Egypt? The quote we're all now thinking of is in Matthew, and it references Hosea 11 verse 1. And if we turn that up in Hosea, it seems to take us to a chapter with very little which looks hopeful initially about the man whose work we are here to remember today, to remind us of God's power and of the kingdom to come. And instead, it seems that this chapter, Hosea 11, initially speaks to us about God's disappointment with Israel and how, despite his calling, they were always turning to something else, perhaps to idols. But again, like Jeremiah, indeed directly in harmony, it tells us how God will always look out for his people. The first part of the passage is the battle, really, against ingrained sin. The reference in Matthew at the start of Christ's life references the start of Hosea, and Hosea chapter 11. And as we read the passage onwards, we see a striking parallel with the frustrations of Christ's ministry against Israel's general pattern of behaviour when called from sin. The chapter moves onwards like this. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Israel called to the Egyptians even as Israel was leaving them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the hand, but they never knew that I healed them. I led them with human cords, with ropes of love. To them I was like one who eases the yoke from their jaws. I bent down to give them food. And then skipping to verse 8. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I surrender you, Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? I have had a change of heart. My compassion is stirred. I will not vent the full fury of my anger. I will not turn back to destroy Ephraim. For I am God and not man, the Holy One among you. I will not come in rage. They will follow the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children will come trembling from the west. They will be roused like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria. Then I will settle them in their homes. This is the Lord's declaration. But even the poorest or humblest people of the land, the common people, were not always ready to accept Jesus' teaching in full. The Messiah should have been their figurehead. We've read yesterday about the man out of whom the legion of demons was removed. And Judea had so many demons which needed to be cast out, so many afflictions on their spiritual health. Remember as well, of course, that Christ had been tried, just been tried, as God's people had been tried, but he had not been found wanting when he was offered the promise of all kingdoms to choose from, in exchange for one apparently simple but terrible thing. But we're talking about the ways of God, not a man. Christ could only have authority if he followed God's ways. He had perfect authority when it came to casting away the torment of the past. But this was only done because he realised that only God could eventually give him power to lead over all kingdoms and all other powers. Only God could do that, and it would take time. The citizens around him in the same land would frustrate him when they were so clearly without this knowledge. But the illustration was still given to them. In the times of Babylon invading Jerusalem, the remnant were quick to take upon them the blessings of the land, and who could blame them after the siege? But they were not as quick to permanently understand the way in which God worked, and the way which he would test them in life with their new blessings. Remember Hosea, they never knew that I healed them. That's what it says. And this also applies to what Jesus found. When that man called Legion, symbolic of all that was wrong with the nation, naked and destitute and indecent amongst the tombs, suffering with so many things, was healed. It was too much for the witnesses, and they did not understand the power of God. The relatively recent Message Bible translation has a very good way of phrasing the reaction of those in the region. It says this: later, a great many people from the Gerasene countryside got together and asked Jesus to leave. Too much change, too fast. And they were scared. So Jesus got back in the boat and set off. The man whom he had delivered from the demons asked to go with him, but he sent him back saying, "Go home and tell everything God did in you." So he went back and preached all over town everything Jesus had done in him. But the people of the Gerasene countryside were left behind, despite such a powerful sign. Now, when we think of that man out of whom so much was cast, we think of perhaps the Epistle of James talking about the difference between the good and bad things coming from the same mouth. And the man who's had those demons was living evidence of these principles, and this should have been a message to all. The Book of James says, "Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? Can a fig tree bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbour bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice." Out of the healed man's mouth was the ultimate testimony, praise and faith, instead of the unspiritual and demonic things which the people of the area needed to cast away. Some of you will be very well aware that the Gerasene countryside may actually be somewhere which was not originally part of the allotted inheritance of Israel and Judah. But it would seem it was somewhere well known to the Jews, and it was somewhere they would have been permitted to go by the Roman authorities. Although largely Greek, it certainly had a Semitic element. There would have been scattered parts here of the children of Israel. Yet, although they were the wrong side of the lake, and the demons, the old way of life, had been drowned in the water, those Jews could not see their future gathering together on the other side of the water. There's some symbolism there, I think. It was too much change, they felt. Too fast. Isn't that typical of how people reacted to Christ's ministry? All the way through, didn't they think they had better things to do, or ways to test him and find something wrong with it, or they sent him away or didn't take him to heart, or felt scared when change was needed and couldn't accept it? And doubtless that's also how people react to God's ways today. Two passages which we've recently read in Luke. The seed that fell among thorns stands for those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by life's worries, riches and pleasures, and they do not mature. The next chapter. Jesus replied, "No one who puts a hand to the plough and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God." Today, we are the poor of the earth, in contrast to many. We're trying to live the positives of that passage from James. We're trying to look forward to a time when there will not be spiritual hunger, but we will remain on the earth to cultivate it and to do the will of our Father. God will make sure that we're not afraid or discouraged, as Jeremiah put it. In the meantime, we will spend a fair proportion of our remaining time under the current state of affairs mixed with the world around us. And for how long this will be, we have no idea. But those poor people in the records of 2 Kings or Jeremiah were cooped up in a starving city for about the longest they could have been expected to endure. And we will face pressures on every side. As with Zedekiah's reign, there will be treachery and terrible consequences in the political circles above and around us. And there will be terrifying conflicts, and more than that, there will be personal issues to overcome. We will also be a remnant, and we will not convince everyone. Some of the people will be personal friends or neighbours, the people next door in the city. One will be taken and the other left. We're only here for the time it takes for God to gather the last few and for his elect to have as much preparation, as much time as is allowed. The last few will have been fed by God's grace in a way which was not physically present when Zedekiah was besieged in Jerusalem. Luke chapter 9 tells a well-worn story of a hungry crowd with a sudden limitless supply of food spread between them. The 5,000 said things about Jesus then. They speculated and they did not quite realise who he was. It was too much, too soon. Too much change for them and too fast. But eventually there will come a time when God needs his spiritual nation to realise quickly that Jesus is God's Messiah. And in this we can be strengthened. And if we appreciate that Jesus is the Messiah, then we will be aware that the bread and the wine is more than just the cultivated produce of the land, something which could be grown by the poorest remnant to feed themselves. Instead, it's taken by us in recognition of the sacrifice, which gives us hope. We know that difficult times lie ahead, for sure, but unlike the treachery of Gedaliah's day or the flight into Egypt, we will instead look to the fact that the story of God's Son was borne out through a flight away from Egypt, and that although his fellow citizens in Israel did not realise it, he came to save them and to save us. How much more personal is it if we do realise what this is all about? Even if we don't taste death before we see the coming of God's kingdom, perhaps we have to accept that we won't necessarily be in the triumphal position that we always secretly hope that we will be, standing there pointing at the sky going, "I told you so." The disciples were exhausted when they climbed the mountain and they fell asleep before the transfiguration. The virgins too all fell asleep, all of them, whether or not their lamps were prepared. We may be on our last legs, on our starvation rations, when the call comes, but we will have just enough. We may only just be able to lift up our heads. We may be a little incoherent, not quite realising the time of day or knowing what to do. It comes like a thief in the night. The great Apostle Peter did not realise this, did not realise what was happening many times in the records that we have of his life. How much more with us? We will be fully awakened, but it will be sudden and it may be as a great surprise. The three disciples didn't even see the coming of the glory of God onto Christ. But like them, we will see it there, fully present, as lightning flashes from east to west. And it will be fully apparent then to everyone. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them. and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." Even if disciples may naturally have some sort of fear of their master, a deep respect, this will not be too much change. And it's certainly not coming too fast. If we're prepared and we're ready, this is the right sort of change. And we can't wait for it. And this bread and this wine lets us remember that one man's sacrifice promises change.
Matthew also records that before the disciples and Jesus went out from that place, they sung a hymn. We will sing together hymn 271. Hymn 271. Now may he who from the dead brought the shepherd of the sheep, Jesus Christ, our living head, from all ill us safely keep. Hymn 271. We've asked Brother Peter Southgate to please close with prayer after we have sung together hymn 277. Be careful for nothing, the Lord is at hand. Remember the glory, remember the land. Be fervent in spirit, be instant in prayer. Work out your salvation with trembling and fear. Hymn 277.